Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision My Coach Cricket Show. My name's David Hinchliffe, and you can find us at pitchvision.com. I have with me today Roy Palmer, who's an author, a cricket coach, and a teacher of the Alexander technique. So he comes at things from a slightly unusual angle, which is why I wanted to talk to him today. Hi, Roy.
Morning, David.
Hello there. As I said, Roy, you approach things from a slightly different angle, which I found interested in your book, Zone Mind, Zone Body, which I've got in front of me here. The sort of subheading of that book is how to break through to new levels of fitness and performance by doing less, which is probably the opposite of what most people think they need to do in order to get better at anything. So if we're looking at it from a cricket point of view, how would you say that you can break through to new levels of fitness and performance by doing less?
Well, yes, I often think about that subtitle because sometimes people think it actually means sitting and putting your feet up. But the doing less actually refers to how you're applying yourself to what you're doing. So for cricketers, I mean, you know, when I played, you know, I'd be standing at the crease, I'd be watching the bowler coming in, I'd be standing there tightening all the muscles I had in my body, and by the time the bowler arrived at the crease, I'd be almost paralysed. And so the doing less refers to what are you doing with your body, whether you're actually playing in a game or whether you're, you know, in the nets or just doing your fitness training. Most of us, without realising it, use too much effort. You know, we're hanging onto the bat for grim death, or the bowler running in, you know, we're tightening our necks and shoulders. And that's actually a bit like putting the brake on when you're trying to drive a car. And so the problem is, the sort of traditional way of approaching things is, yes, if you want to do better, you have to try harder. You know, that sort of games teachers at school would have sort of drilled us into us, you know, you're not trying hard enough. And what did that mean to us? You know, probably we just gritted our teeth, showed a bit more determination, and looked as if we were trying harder, whereas in fact probably what we're doing is interfering with our movement and adding unnecessary effort. And from my own point of view, from many sports people I've worked with over the last 10 years, I see exactly the same sort of habit. And once you can get people to take that handbrake off, if you like, then suddenly things can become a lot easier.
This is quite closely related to something that I've spoken about in the past, which I don't know if I'm the first person to come up with it, but what I call it is the paradox of timing, which particularly when you're talking about batting, is the harder you try and hit the ball, the less distance you seem to be able to get on it.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to look at, I mean, the likes of, you know, David Gower and Brian Lara, you know, when they were at their peak, they would just look as if they were stroking the ball and it's at the boundary before you know it. And it's a matter of coordination. And from what you say, the harder you try, when you actually try harder to do something, we're actually, you know, from a physiological point of view, sending more signals from the higher parts of the brain through to the muscles.
Hmm.
Whereas, in fact, I think of it as we're a bit like a captain of an ocean liner. You know, we decide which direction we're going in, but he then doesn't go down to the engine room and shovel coal into the furnace. Hmm. If you like, we have the thought of what you want to do with the ball, but all of the coordination should happen at a lower level. And so, and most of us, you know, have this experience in any sport. The best shot we played probably felt as if it was the easiest shot we played, simply because we had no sense of effort. And we got the coordination and the timing right, and then effectively, you know, the lower parts of your brain that will coordinate your muscle activity will do that for you. And so, yes, it's quite often the harder we try, it just tends to mean we furrow our brows, we grit our teeth, and we tighten up. And it doesn't allow for good coordination, and obviously, therefore, the timing's wrong.
And this is where the Alexander technique side of it comes into it, because that's the big part of that is sort of the link between the body and the mind. Is that right?
Yes, it's to recognise that every thought that we have, whether we're conscious of what we're thinking or not, has an impact somewhere in your body, on your muscles. You can trace every pathway from your brain, and it will come eventually to a muscle somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, when we call it body language, we recognise when someone's nervous. We can recognise when someone's angry because we do something with our face and our shoulders, or we grit our teeth or clench our fists. And from a cricketing point of view, I mean, people maybe think back to like Viv Richards swaggering to the wicket. You know, he just looked full of confidence. And what effect does that have on the bowler? So what we're thinking has an immediate effect on our muscles and therefore our actions. Under the Alexander technique, it's more widely known for treating back pain, and actually the British Medical Journal have just printed the results of a long-term study that found it to be the most effective way for treating back pain. But in fact, it's about how you're thinking and what effect that's having on your body. And so I call it sort of getting into the moment or being in the zone, where we are far more conscious of the effect that we're having on our actions by what we're thinking. And it's to tie the two up. I mean, the trouble is we use the terms mind and body, whereas in fact there's no separation. You know, that there are mind training techniques, or there's physical training, or, you know, mental training. Whereas in fact you can't separate the two, because whatever we're doing, the two impact on each other. And so, I mean, Alexander himself, he used the term the self, but it's the language can be a bit limiting really when we try to talk about some of these aspects. So yes, it's really just trying to get into our own sort of I use the word body again because there's no better word, but just to better understand, you know, how we're actually acting at each specific time.
So it's a more of an integrated approach, where you, instead of compartmentalizing things into, right, today I'm going to work on my mental skills, tomorrow I'm going to go to the gym, I'm doing my fitness skills, and the day after that I'm going to the nets and I'm going to do my cricket skills.
Yeah, integration. I mean, that's the absolute, the best description of it. Because yes, when you're at the gym, you know, too many people switch off, or they just start watching the MTV or put their iPod on. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but so long as it doesn't take you out of the activity. I mean, I use a gym, but when I'm there, I try to focus on what I'm doing, how I'm doing, and you get far more from it then. You know, it helps you listen to what's happening in your body, and then where you're better able to appreciate how you can control certain aspects, you know, of your game. So, a bowler running into bowl, yes, he's done his work at the gym, you know, he's developed the muscles, he's done his work in the net. But as you say, it shouldn't be compartmentalized. You can do all of that in one go. You know, he could do that running up to bowl. He can focus on what he's thinking, what he wants to do. He can focus on how he's moving, how he's running. And if he's freeing up any tension in his body, then the coordination is going to be there. And so you get this full integration. And yes, the problem is we do tend to split things up, sometimes for convenience, really, because, you know, the most teams now will have a sports psychologist, and that's absolutely fine. But again, it's to bear in mind, and the psychologist will know, that a confident player stands better, walks better, moves better, and simply because, as I say, it's your thoughts will have an influence on every action that you perform.
That's interesting, because I was in the gym this morning, and here in the UK, it's the season's pretty much over now. So I've started training more on a sort of strength side of things rather than maintaining things during the season. What I find is, you were talking about at the beginning, focusing gives you sort of a better feel of it. What I find is that when I go into the gym, I've got my Walkman on, but I have to take it off when I do the heavier part of the weight training, because it's too distracting to have the music going on at the same time as trying to lift up a heavy weight.
Yeah, especially if there's a beat going as well, isn't it? You find that you start training to the beat, which is not necessarily most, as you say, appropriate for if you're lifting weights. I do a lot of road running, but I use treadmills in the gym for the shorter, sort of faster sort of training. And I find if they've got a football match on the screen when I'm running, any time I get anywhere near the goal, I'm there with them, and, you know, it interrupts my strike because I'm almost kicking the ball.
Yes.
And so it can be a distraction. I mean, as I say, you can actually, I think research has found classical music is the best music to train to. Because that's something to do with the beat not interfering. But again, it all boils down to, are you focused on what you're doing? And again, strength training, is fine. But again, when you get back to the cricket, can you be sure that you're using your new sort of built-up strength in those particular areas accordingly? Are you using it more appropriately? I've seen cricketers that have developed tremendous strength in their legs, for instance. But when they get to the crease, it's that they're overusing their legs and effectively tightening their backs and then restricting their mobility. And so we have to be careful of, you know, what we're building, where we're building it, you know, the strength, and then how we're going to use that when we get back to the sport.
Linking strength to skill, yeah, that's an important one for me as well. Let's talk a little bit more about the practical side of it, because this all sounds great, but probably what most people are thinking at this point is, that's great, but what do I do? Because I know what I need to do to, I know what I need to do to train for fitness. I need to go to the gym. You know, I know what I need to do to improve my bowling skills. I need to go down to the net. What practical things can I do to link everything together, like we've been talking about?
One of the first things, so I teach sort of the exams technique to generally to individuals. And one of the and from all sports, I've had people from, you know, a lot of cricketers, horse riders, martial artists are keen on this technique. I've started to work more now with golfers. And the first thing I get everybody to do, because everybody usually comes either because they've got an injury, a niggling injury, or they have a technical problem with their game and they're really struggling to try to correct it. The first thing, and you know, your listeners can try this now, is I get them to try a very straightforward exercise, which is just to fold their arms. So if you try folding your arms, and then look down and see which way you folded your arms, and then try to reverse that pattern. And you may find you have to stop and think about how do you change it. So if your right hand is tucked in, you need to bring it on the outside and you know, tuck your left hand in. People have to stop and think about that, and it feels wrong when they get there. You know, it's not the way they choose to fold their arms. Now, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just the way you fold your arms. So what's the point of doing this particular little exercise? It's to recognize that your habits play a huge part in what you do when you're playing. Because if you've still got your arms folded in the opposite way and it feels odd, try next time when you fold your arms to change and do it the opposite way. Now, the odds on are you'll completely forget to do it because you'll fold your arms unconsciously in response to something that's happened around you. And you would never choose to do it in a way that feels wrong, i.e. fold it the opposite way. And this is the problem when people are playing their sport, and whether you're applying yourself to, you know, in the gym, or whether you're running up to bowl, or squatting behind the stumps, you do things in a way that feel right. But the problem is, it's habits that dictate what are right. So if you've got bad habits, so a lot of, bowlers, for instance, you know, if they don't feel they're generating the pace that their coach or they think they're capable of, quite often it's down to this thing of, you know, putting the brake on before they release the ball, i.e. tightening neck and shoulders. But they do that because it feels right, because that's what they feel has to be done when they get to the wicket. If you've only got to do something, you know, for a dozen times or so for an evening in the net, and it starts to become a habit, and so a conditioned reflex, you know, to give it its proper term. And so if you run up to bowl and it's every time you get towards the crease, you start to lift and tense your shoulders. If you do that for an evening, then when you go back the following session of the nets, you're going to start doing the same thing again. And so the first thing I get everybody to do is to recognize that what they're doing may not be the best way of doing it. And so we have to undo our reliance on what feels right. And because the difficulty is, if you ask the bowler to run up and not to tighten his neck, first of all, he's not aware that he's doing it because it's become a habit. And then secondly, it's not going to feel right. So we have to get over this reliance on doing things that feel right, because in fact what we're doing is the same old habits. I do this with runners, you know, they run in a way that feels right to them. Mm. But when you try and change that and ask them to run in a slightly different way, and again, it comes down to practicals and each person's different, they'll all have their own little habits. Some of them say, well, it feels like cheating because I'm running but I can't feel any effort involved with it. And so this is a problem. It's to get over that first hurdle of, well, if I've got a problem with my game, then what I'm doing, there must be something wrong with it. But the hardest thing is to actually go back and change that. And so from a practical point of view, it's to be able to experiment, to try something different. And for the first few times you'll try it, you know, you may get it horribly wrong. But it's to go through that because unless you can do something different, you've got nothing to compare with what you're already doing. And so you don't know if, you know, the way you run in and bowl, for instance, is the most efficient and effective way to generate pace.
Mm.
You won't know until you can try and do it in a different way. But as I say, habits are very difficult to kill off sometimes. But so long as we can keep an open mind and be willing to experiment and to get it wrong several times, you know, then we have a better chance of finding an alternative and hopefully a more efficient, better way to do it. That was a long answer, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was a good one as well. And so how do you, say you're a fast bowler and you want to bowl faster, as a lot of people contact me saying, you know, I want to be able to bowl faster. You know, what do I need to do with this part of my technique? What do I need to do with that part of my technique? How would you identify whether you are having these sort of leaks, if you like, in technique, and you're doing things which are holding you back from bowling at the maximum speed you can bowl at? How would you go about identifying that? Would you have to work with an Alexander technique practitioner, or with the simpler things you can do than that?
It's one approach, definitely, because actually for most people it's not a problem with their bowling technique as such. Although, you know, an experienced coach will have a look at someone and think, yep, they're not doing this correctly, or, you know, they've not got the timing right. An Alexander teacher and myself, we would actually take it back several steps, if you like, and before looking at them bowling, or to get them to think about what they're doing when they're bowling, you'd start with something very straightforward, an everyday activity. For instance, just either walking or getting out of a seat, or getting out of a chair. Because most of us, it's the what I call the building blocks of movement that need addressing. So when somebody's coming in to bowl, you know, they're sort of obviously using arms and legs, and I mean, bowling is quite an unusual sort of action. It's obviously quite unique in sporting activity. It's not the easiest of things to coordinate. But if you can look at the building blocks, if you like, the basic movement patterns, so that involves, you know, leg swinging from the hips, the lower leg swinging from the knee, getting the right sort of spring and bounce off the ground as they're approaching the wicket. If you can go right back to some of those basics, you look at those first, and then it's like a jigsaw puzzle. You put them together. And so, for instance, you can, I know it sounds a bit odd and people struggle with this sometimes, you can teach people an awful lot about themselves and their movement by taking them in and out of a chair. Because what most of us do is to throw the kitchen sink at it. We tighten our necks, push in our lower backs, tighten the legs, and we make it much harder than it ought to be. Whereas if you can take somebody out of a chair by preventing them from interfering with the coordination, as an Alexander teacher, you'd look at what's happening in the neck and shoulder areas and bring it to their attention. You can give them a different experience of movement. And from that, you can learn that actually it doesn't take half as much effort as you think it does to, for instance, to get out of a chair. When you can experience that you don't need to put in all that effort, or you don't need to tighten anything to perform a sort of a coordinated action like that, you can then take it into slightly more complex movements like walking and then into running. And so to give people an experience of moving with far less effort and allowing the coordination to happen by itself. And so the problem is, if you like, it's quite often people are trying to correct a problem. So our bowler trying to bowl faster, it probably leads, and in most cases it will lead to them trying harder, which brings us right back to this thing, well, I've got to tighten my muscles a little bit more. I've got to, you know, stiffen my neck. I've got to, you know, try and bring my arm over quicker. Whereas, in fact, all these things, like a golfer swinging a club, it's to do with momentum. And so the problem is, it's to give our bowler, if you like, an experience of movement without the effort. And then he can apply his newfound knowledge, i.e. what is it like to move without tightening my neck or shoulders or my lower back, to allow my legs to sort of to swing free. Now, I always say to whatever sport people are playing, say, watch some of the top runners. I mean, everybody's been amazed by Usain Bolt. When you watch the sideways camera following him running at God knows how many miles per hour to do the 100 meters in the time that he can do it, you'll see what I think of as the most efficient technique. It's all in his arms and legs. And his torso, if you like, is practically undisturbed by it all. He's letting go in all of the right places and allowing, you know, the floor to push him up and forward. And so people have to get this experience of moving in a more coordinated way by interfering less. And then with that newfound knowledge, then you're far better placed to be able to listen to your coach and to be able to put into practice what he's asking you to do. And I mean, I found this with martial arts. I'd been doing karate for 10 years before I started doing the Alexander technique, and I'd got to black belt. But it wasn't until I started to appreciate this new way of thinking with regards to movement that I was able to understand a lot more about karate, and I came on leaps and bounds then, because suddenly it felt a lot easier. This is coming back to this doing less. You know, most of us need to learn to do less and allow your body to be able to do more. And so it is basically, it's breaking everything back down to the basic movement patterns to be able to then apply that back to your activity. I mean, in cricket now, there's a lot of talk of biomechanics, and there's a lot of very clever, you know, software out there to, you know, video players and to watch what they're doing. But you still got to remember that the mind is involved in that. And so I think this links in, and so you can use all of this technology, but you're better able to apply what you know then needs to be done. And so the problem is, I feel a lot of people don't have that ability to be able to carry out, you know, coaching instructions simply because the basic movement patterns aren't there.
It's quite interesting because there's a physical therapist in America called Gray Cook who says something very similar. He has something called the Optimum Performance Pyramid, which is a pyramid where you build one thing on top of another, and the base of that pyramid is movement, and then you build performance on top of that, you know, fitness, that kind of thing, and skill on top of that. So sort of skill is the top of the pyramid, if you like, the peak of it, and movement lies at the bottom of it. And he has a thing called a functional movement screen where he tests people for their basic movement skills on very basic patterns, like being able to squat down on the ground, step into a lunge position, that kind of thing. And it's not a fitness test. It's a very simple movement test. But a lot of people struggle on some things which you'd think are very simple movements, like being able to step over a very low hurdle without wobbling and things like that. So it's quite an interesting test. And his book is called Athletic Body in Balance, so that's one worth looking out for. But just going back to those basic movements, where would you say, what were the practical things that people could do to help improve those basic movements?
We sort of look at it as maintaining a sort of internal dialogue with yourself. So certain questions you can ask. Whatever activity you're doing, whether you're driving your car or whether you're, you know, standing at the crease, the first thing I get people to think about is, what are they doing with their jaw? To tighten your jaw, which is very common. I mean, I used to do it all the time. I didn't realize until it was brought to my attention. But if you're gritting your teeth or tightening your jaw, and you can see this in, you know, most people, again, certain activities they're doing, but you won't see it in top sprinters like Bolt. You know, their jaws will actually bounce as they run. If you tighten your jaw, it will stiffen your jaw muscles, obviously, but it'll also tighten your neck. And those muscles are incredibly sensitive and involved in your coordination. So whatever activity you're doing, if you just think to yourself, well, you can allow your lips to stay together, but just let the teeth part a fraction. It just softens the jaw and just releases the muscles of the face. And that will have a knock-on effect to the muscles of your neck. And so when you're running into bowl, or whether you're standing there at the crease waiting to, you know, for the bowler to get there, you can just, without it distracting you, because obviously you can't be too internal and then suddenly find your middle stumps out of the ground.
Yes.
But it's just to ask these questions. So you could start with your jaw and then just have ask the question, what am I doing my shoulders? And sometimes even just to say the word shoulders to yourself, you may find that those shoulders relax a little. If you're sort of either, you know, if you're fielding, you know, if you're in the slips or behind the wicket or the, you know, the batsman, we're all going to be in various degrees of a squat. And you can think to yourself there, am I tightening my legs to maintain this position? You don't actually have to tighten. A lot of people pull down their hamstrings to pull themselves into a squat. You don't have to do that. You just have to be aware of softening your ankles, letting go behind your knees, and remember to bend forward from the hip joints so you're not tightening your lower back. Another important factor is what's underneath me. Again, some of these sound, you know, pretty bizarre, really, but in fact, if you have a sense of what's underneath you, so if your listeners are sitting down or standing up at the moment, it's to appreciate that there is your body weight passes into the floor and there's a push that comes back up. And that can help with things like, you know, staying poised. So, you know, if you're standing at the crease, if you've got a sense of the floor underneath pushing you back up, then you can stay a little more poised, a little more free in your movement. And even something as basic as being aware of your toes in your socks whilst you're standing there can just help to give you a sensation of yourself standing in a particular position, waiting for something to happen. And so, as I say, it just helps to free up any tension that you may be applying. I mean, I stood at the crease and been literally paralyzed by the time the bowl was arrived. Whereas if you can just maintain these thoughts, you just stay a little freer in your movement. And I like that idea of this pyramid. You know, movement is paramount. I mean, perhaps you could even add a layer beneath that. The thinking part, the concept of what's involved when you move. And this brings us back to this idea of habits again. But certainly, I mean, something like this, I mean, I'll bring them out in my book, you know, some very practical techniques that are not too difficult to apply. You just, again, it's just this being able to try something different. And so, you know, ask everyone if they're in the nets. Okay, you know, nets, serious practice. And again, I know Greg Chappell has this beef with nets and feels that people don't get enough from nets because it can't replicate a real game. But be prepared to experiment in the nets. You know, you're going to have a couple of failures. But as I say, it's when you're standing in the nets next time and somebody's running into bowl, just check what you're doing with your jaw. You know, it's until you try it, you don't know effectively. So, try them out. Be prepared to try something different and to put the focus somewhere else.
So what it all links back to really is the mind controlling the body, the body's actions, or in a lot of cases, the body getting rid of the actions which are causing you problems, like tensing up.
I think it's to also think of it. Again, I know I've said earlier that mind and body can be, you know, sort of distracting, if you like, and not the right words, but we don't have any better words. But it's also the thing that the body can distract the mind. You know, I said to people, if you're playing and you've got a corn under your big toe, then that's going to affect your movement. This way of thinking, if you like, and it's something like the Alexander technique, it's to recognize it works both ways. So it's a thinking thing, if you like, those sort of practical steps I mentioned, but also to listen, to get a sense of what's happening in the body. And I mentioned briefly about this idea of concept of movement. Again, we have these parts of the brain, which are called the body map, which effectively contains a map of your whole body. But that can be sort of corrupted, if you like, by poor movement. And so somebody who walks badly will continue to walk badly because that's the only way they know how to walk. And scientists have found, looking into repetitive strain injury, that part of the brain can actually become corrupt. And so then we have a map that isn't telling us how it should be. You mentioned skill in that pyramid earlier. My favourite definition of skill is being able to minimise the discrepancy between what you want to happen and what actually wants to happen. I mean, I'm sure we've all stood there and the ball's come down and we thought, yeah, this one's going over the ropes. And either we've missed it completely or just hit it along on. And so I feel something like with the Alexander technique or with these sort of particular practical ways of training help you gain a better understanding of what you're doing with your body and therefore allow you to minimise that gap. So when you want to do something, you have a better idea of how to carry out or how to allow your body to carry out the movements to execute what you had in mind. And as I say, if you can minimise that, then your skill levels will rise. And I mean, you see it in a lot of children, what we call like a natural ability. There's a lad who comes down to the cricket club I'm at, he's only 10 years old, and you know, he can bowl like Shane Warne almost at the moment, just by watching him. And you see this lad has great movement, full of confidence, has no idea of failure. But the problem is, as we get older, that's when we start to have other activities. We get stressed in our school, our exams and our work, and that's when we start to get this interference. And then this idea of doubt creeping in and fear of failure. And so we can lose that natural ability. And the problem was, if it was a natural ability to start, we never knew really how or why we had it. And so, you know, I feel by focusing on some of these practical aspects of the movement, then we can appreciate what makes us good at something in particular. And therefore, if we do have an injury, or for some reason a loss of confidence, or, you know, a dip in form, we can go back to the drawing board, back to the basics, and work our way back the way we came initially. But so too many sports people, I feel, once they've injured, they've lost that natural ability, because it was never at a conscious level, if you like, or they're never aware of what sort of factors or aspects made them good at what they could do.
Absolutely, and the unconscious mind is a very powerful thing if you let it do what it can do, which is brings us on to really the whole idea of the zone and what sports psychologists might call ideal performance state, or whatever you want to call it. It's that feeling where everything's just working and you don't have to think about it.
And yeah, from my point of view as well, and what I bring out in the book is that's when I feel we are interfering or not interfering at all. You know, everything's happening at an optimum and integrated level. We're in the right frame of mind. We are focused. And all of this coordination, you know, the complex coordination that goes into, you know, some of our cricketing, you know, sort of skills, mm-hmm. they're all there. You know, if we've played cricket for any number of years, the skills are there. It's being able to allow them to come to the surface, if you like. And so, yes, when we're in the zone or in the flow, it all just seems so much easier. And I think also looking at the brain, the sort of processing speed is so much quicker. You're able to draw on your portfolio of skills, if you like, at will and very quickly. And of course, as soon as you get into that, it's then self-motivating. You know, when you're seeing a ball the size of a football, and you're playing all of your shots with ease, then that just helps to build on the confidence, and it's, you know, just continue to take you up and up and up, if you like. The problem is when people think, hey, I'm in the zone, and then that sort of recognition sometimes then adds a little bit of interference that's not needed, and then we drop back out of it. But I mean, we've all experienced it. It doesn't have to be in sport. You know, we've had days in the office when everything is just straightforward and easy. We have a smart answer for everything. And, you know, however complex, we just seem better able to cope. Because then there's the opposite, you know, when you just feel like a complete novice and nothing's happening and we're caught by surprise, if you like, then suddenly the ball's on us and we don't know what to do with it. But obviously the zone's the optimal state, but what I feel is it's almost should be a natural state, and we should almost drift into it. And I quite often use the analogy with falling asleep. You know, you can lie in bed there and your mind's wandering away, and suddenly you drift into this state where it's almost like you're watching a film. You know, the thoughts aren't ones that you've put there. It's, you know, you're slowly drifting off into sleep. But as soon as you think to yourself, oh, I'm falling asleep, then bang, you're straight back out of it and awake again. And so I feel it's something that we need to put into place for certain the situation that allows us to get into the zone. And this comes back to those practical things, asking yourself the questions, you know, what's happening in your body and, you know, what the floor is doing for you, etc., and getting a sense of yourself in the moment. And then we will actually get into the zone far more often. But as soon as we try, and this all comes back to this very first thing we're talking about, this trying harder, then we interfere with the whole process and add layers of tension and complexities, if you like, that will keep us out of the zone.
Absolutely. When I read your book, I tried this myself, and it definitely makes a big difference simply by changing the way you think about how you're standing and you know what you're doing. It makes an enormous difference. But what one area where I'm a little bit confused about, if you like, is where there's some kind of dysfunction in the body where just by knowing that it exists doesn't get rid of it. So to give you a practical example, somebody who perhaps is, because of they've been playing say cricket, because cricket's a good example, because they're say a bowler, they've got an imbalance in the strength and stability and the mobility of their body between the left hand side and the right hand side, because one side is doing a lot more than the other side when you're bowling. Now, researchers have shown that if you have a difference between one side and the other side, left and right hand side of your body, that increases your chance of getting an injury. So looking at it from your point of view, where the answer might be, the traditional answer might be, well, you know, if you're weaker on the left hand side, then you train twice as much on the left hand side than you do on the right hand side to bring up that weakness. But looking at it from your point of view, where does that fit into your model or your ideas?
I mean, I would look at it from what has that person been doing and how have they been doing it? And not just in a cricketing sense, but in their daily activities. I mean, it doesn't matter how often we play cricket, we are still going to be sitting in chairs, walking or driving cars more than we're playing cricket. And because we don't suddenly change our body when we put the whites on and go out and play. And so it's not just looking at it from a cricket point of view, it's how is that person using themselves in their everyday activities and looking at coordination. I mean, you probably find very few people are symmetrical. You know, we're either right or left-handed, we all do particular activities that involve more, you know, muscles more on one side than the other. So I would still look at it as a total coordination. I see the thinking behind getting the balance, but I still, you know, between the left and the right, for instance, but I still think if your coordination is good and your timing is good, then your muscles are conditioned for what you do. I mean, if you think of a carpenter who would be sawing wood all day with his right hand, he's constantly going to be twisting his upper body to saw the wood. Now, he needs to do that action to saw the wood. I mean, they find skeletons from archers, you know, from way back in King Henry's time, and they know they're archers because their bones are bigger on one side of the body. Now, I don't think, you know, the king would have appreciated all of his archers being balanced up, because then that would have interfered with their firing an arrow, if you like. So I see it as a coordination thing, and if you're going to bowl, you know, sort of so many overs a season, then yes, that will, you know, sort of develop strength more in one side than the other. But it's the how. It's not the action. Now, people say you shouldn't run, it's bad for your joints. It's not. It's how you run that's bad for your joints. And it's how you bowl that is going to cause the injury, not the bowling itself. I mean, you think of bowlers like Michael Holding. You know, how many years he bowled, and he never suffered a serious injury. Freddie Truman, probably bowled far more than today's bowlers do. But again, he managed to escape serious injury throughout his life. And, you know, you can look at his action, and probably today people think, oh, crikey, you shouldn't be bowling like that. You know, you think of all the javelin approach almost. And so it's not the action sometimes. It's, the action of bowling, it's a coordination thing. And it all boils down to those basic movement building blocks again. And so if you can resolve those issues, so again, what is that person bringing to that technique? Then I say, once you get something better coordinated, then there's less chance of injury. I sort of use the analogy of if you drive your car badly, you know, you can take it to the garage. You know, if you've caused damage through driving it badly, you can take it to the garage and the guy there can fix it for you. But as soon as you get back in your car and drive out of the garage and start doing the same things, you're going to cause the same mechanical problems.
Sure.
So what you need to do is to reassess and go and have some driving lessons, so somebody can point out your bad driving habits, and therefore you're not going to put the same things wrong. And again, you can balance people up. If you perform these particular exercises to get them balanced, are they going to go back and bowl in a similar way and to start the whole process again? Because if we assume that they were fairly balanced before they started bowling, then that they've been doing something maybe to interfere with that coordination, and they will continue to do that until you bring it back to the basics of coordination again. Not in every case, but as I say, quite often it's something that we're doing that's causing the problem, not the actual action that we're doing. So that's why some bowlers are always injured and other bowlers never appear to get injured.
So learning the movement patterns rather than going back, really, back again, we're talking about going back to learning those movement patterns and getting those movement patterns right.
Yes, again, it's to get the building blocks right, so you can then put them together and take them back to your cricketing activity.
I'm going to throw a couple of terms at you now. Just let me know what you think and how they fit in. Core stability and yoga.
Core stability, I mean, in martial arts, and so we used to focus on the same area called the hara. The Japanese refer to it as the hara. But we were told not to do anything with it, if you like. It was to have a sense that that is your centre of gravity. And I feel it's overdone. Pilates is probably the better known system for working on core stability. And Joseph Pilates devised his techniques for people who were literally bedridden, who couldn't move. And they worked superbly, because they were able to work on muscles that they couldn't work on otherwise, because they were stuck in, lying flat on their backs, practically paralysed. I feel it's overdone now. I feel people who can, play cricket and don't have a huge problem don't need to worry too much about core stability. I think if we can move well and we're coordinated well, all of those muscles will be conditioned and worked for what you need to do. So I think it can be overdone. It does have a role in rehabilitation where there's a bad injury, but I just think it's overused for in athletes. And I see young people doing them, they join a club and the first thing they do is they get someone working on their core stability. And I sometimes see people it's not helped them. It's built up tension in areas where they don't need tension. I know it's quite controversial, this, because core stability is widely accepted, as a good way of training. And as I agree up to a certain point, but I just think it's overused. Whereas something like yoga or Tai Chi, again, it depends how yoga's taught. Yoga has been a bit westernized recently. Funny enough, there was something in the New York Times a few months ago about the number of yoga injuries doctors were seeing in their clinics, which yoga and injury shouldn't be two words that are ever mentioned in the same sentence.
This is where you have sort of hot yoga and power yoga.
And it's where people get competitive and think, I can bend further than them, or I can do this, and that's not the point of yoga. And I think some people refer to it as leotard yoga. It's not. I mean, my Alexander teacher, Ray Evans, he was a yoga teacher back in the 60s, and he would say that it has changed too much in this country, if you like. It was seen as a philosophy almost, in a way of life, and the movements were not important. The positions were not important. It was how you obtained, the stances. And so I think a proper yoga is, again, it's a great way of developing self-awareness. Whilst increasing flexibility, you don't have to try to get into the deep positions, because if you get the thinking right, then, the movements themselves will help to increase your flexibility. And I think the problem is we start to look at the movement or the end position as the be all end all, but it's not. It's a focus on the movement. It's the same with Tai Chi. It promotes this idea of freer, easier movement with a sense of yourself whilst you're doing it. Developing your conscious awareness whilst you're performing particular acts. And things like yoga and Tai Chi are great for developing that awareness, which is good for any sport. But so I do feel sometimes there's too much done on particular areas of the body that I feel, again, are going to actually cause problems with coordination. Because those, certainly the core muscles, if you like, and there is still quite a debate going on. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the late Dr. Mel Siss, quite a renowned sports scientist in the States. He was very sort of anti-core work or a lot of this sort of strengthening activity, because he felt that it it didn't allow the body to coordinate itself. And he had a wonderful term. He said, the body knows of movements, not muscles.
Mm.
So if we're going to lift an arm, you don't think, well, I'm going to contract. You know, if you're going to bend your arm, you don't think you're going to contract your bicep. You just think, I'm going to bend my arm. And your body will coordinate what needs to be done. And so I feel, you know, it's great. Some of these things are great for rehab or for a serious injury, but I just feel they're a little overdone sometimes. And again, if something's repeated often enough, people assume it must be true or must be the right way. Whereas I think perhaps we ought to ask a little more questions before we start going down the path of developing, you know, some of these muscles. When really, as I said, we should just look at the basics, the coordination.
Yeah.
And I've heard of cricketers, if you play cricket well, the muscles you need for playing cricket will develop quite happily.
Very true. I agree as well. One of the things that Greg Chappell says in his book is that it's important to, if you're going to do any kind of fitness training, it's important to try and link it in as closely to cricket skills as possible.
I mean, Greg's book, I mean, you know, I recommend that to everybody, every cricketer I work with. The Making of Champions, isn't it?
That's right. It's called...
I was lucky enough to meet Greg.
It's called Greg Chappell on Coaching.
Is it Making of Champions? Oh, it was called The Making of Champions in Australia. That's got a different title here. But yeah, it's an excellent book because he looks at the top players, doesn't he? And looks at the characteristics that made them great. And I was lucky enough to meet Greg a few years ago. He actually, I gave him a few Alexander sessions, which was golf. And he's got such a sharp mind, and he very quickly picked up what I was trying to get across and how that could apply for cricketers or any sports person. But yeah, his book is well worth a read because, yes, he asks the questions, doesn't he? Why is it we do this? And he has an excellent chapter in his book about him and his brothers playing in their back garden.
Yeah.
And I'm sure most cricketers reading that will all sort of, it'll bring back memories for them, you know, when your shed was the pavilion and you came walking out and you were whoever the star was of the day, and you played almost a whole test match in your back garden with your mates or your brothers. But all of that training, he realised years later, you know, to play a game where there was pressure on him, you know, but having fun at the same time paid, well, obviously for the Chappell brothers, it paid huge dividends. But again, it isn't about having an emphasis and an objective to everything that you're doing without it getting, you know, too serious or, you know, too complicated. But no, as I say, there's an excellent chapter in his book, and I'm sure everybody reading that will bring back memories of the old backyard cricket.
Absolutely, which kind of brings everything back full circle, back to what we've been talking about really, which is that integration of everything. And I think that's probably a good place to leave it. Just to say that your book, Roy, is still available on Amazon, I think it is.
Yeah, it's on Amazon. Most bookshops will have it, if they don't order it. But yeah, just Amazon probably the easiest place to find it.
I'll put a link up to the book in the show notes. It's called Zone Mind, Zone Body. It's an excellent book, and it really goes into not only the concepts but also the practical steps that you can take to start making a difference, and you can really start making a difference straight away, because as soon as I read the book myself, I started applying some of the things straight away and in my next training session as well, and it really makes a big difference straight away. So it's highly recommended. The other books that we talked about in the interview, Greg Chappell's book and Gray Cook's book, they're both worth a read as well, and I'll put links up to those as well for anyone who's interested in that. So I think that's going to wrap it up. Thanks very much for taking the time to have a chat with me today, Roy.
Thanks very much. Thanks for calling.
All right. Speak to you again soon.
Okay. Thanks very much, then.
Bye.
Carry on.